This conference will now be recorded.
Welcome, everybody, to the Messianic Message and Tabernacle of David Study Room. We are going to be studying today the Torah portion Vayeshev. That's Genesis 37, starting at verse 1 to chapter 40, verse 23, and Amos chapter 2, verses starting at 6 to chapter 3, verse 8, and then Matthew 1 through 6, and 16 through 25. Those are the Torah portion, the Haftarah, and the Brit Hadashah, and Rick is going to pray for us to start our meeting.
Father, we just thank you so much for allowing us to come here before you and to learn of your word. We ask that you would open our ears and open our understanding so that we will receive your word in Yeshua's name. Amen.
Amen. So I will get started. We're going to go around the room here, and we have additional people with us here in this room. We have Charles and Yako. So I'll read, Michael will read, then Charles, Yako, and then Rick will read, and then we'll start with Susan in the online room. Genesis 37:1. Jacob lived in the land of his father's travels in the land of Canaan. This is the history of the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wife. Excuse me, his father's wives. Joseph brought an evil report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all of his children because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him all the more.
So he said to them, "Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf." And his brothers said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and his words. Then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Look, I have dreamed another dream. And this time the sun and the moon and the 11 stars bowed down to me." So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you?"
His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Now his brothers had gone to graze their father's flocks near Shechem, and Israel said to Joseph, "As you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I am going to send you to them." "Very well," he replied. So he said to them, "Go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flocks, and bring word back to me." Then he sent him off from the valley of Hebron. When Joseph arrived at Shechem, a man found him wandering around in the field and asked him, "What are you looking for?"
And he said, "I am seeking for my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding." And the man said, "They are gone from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" And Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. And when they saw him afar off, even before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. And they said to one another, "Behold, this dreamer comes. Therefore come now, and let us kill him, and throw him into some pit, and we will say some evil beast has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams.
But Reuben heard and rescued him from their hands and said, "Let us not strike his being." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, in order to rescue him out of their hands and bring him back to his father." So it came to be, when Joseph had come to his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his robe, the long robe which was on him, and they took him and threw him into a pit. And the pit was empty, and there was no water in it. And they sat down to eat a meal, and they lifted up their eyes and looked and saw a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices and balm and myrrh and going to take them down to Mitzrayim.
And Susan.
And Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then some Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph into Ephraim. Now Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, so he tore his garments. And he returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go?"
Jimmy, Genesis 37, verses 31 through 36, please finish this chapter. Thank you. Jimmy? Okay, Glenn, verses 31 through 36, please.
Okay, hang on. I'm going slow here.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm reading along and I didn't have the mic on. I'm very sorry.
Okay, go ahead, Jimmy, and then Glenn can read the next part.
Okay, so should I start over then?
Yeah, start with 31 and then go through the end of the chapter.
All right. They took Joseph's coat and killed a male goat and dipped the coat in the blood. They took the coat of many colors and they brought it to their father and said, "We have found this. Examine it now, whether it is your son's coat or not." He recognized it and said, "It is my son's coat. An evil animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn in pieces." Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his waist and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. He said, "For I will go down to Sheol to my son's mourning." His father wept for him. The Midianites sold him into Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's, the captain of the guard.
And Glenn, chapter 38, verses 1 through 5, please.
It was at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned away toward an Adullamite man whose name was Hira. There Judah saw the daughter of a prominent merchant whose name was Shua. He married her and consorted with her. She conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Er. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. And yet again she bore a son and called his name Shelah. And it was in Chesiv when she bore him.
Douglas, 36 through 10, please. I'm sorry, 6 through 10, chapter 38, 6 through 10.
Okay. And Judah took a wife for his firstborn, whose name was Tamar. And Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord slew him. And Judah said to Onan, "Go in unto thy brother's wife and marry her and raise up seed to thy brother. And Onan knew that the seed should not be his. And it came to pass when he went into his brother's wife that he spilled it on the ground, lest that he should give seed to his brother. And the thing which he did displeased the Lord, wherefore he slew him also.
And Sarah, verses 11 through 15.
Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown. For he said, lest ye also die like his brothers. And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. Now in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. And Judah was comforted and went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah. He and his wife, Hara and Adullamite, and it was Tamar saying, Luke, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So she took off her widow's garment, covered herself with the veil, and wrapped herself, and sat in an open place which was on the way to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given to him as a wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, because she was covered, she had covered her face.
And Hilary, 16 through 20, please.
And he turned unto her by the way and said, go, I pray you, let me come in to you. For he knew not that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, what will you give me that you may come unto me? And he said, I'll send you a kid from the flock. And she said, will you give me a pledge till you send it? And he said, what pledge shall I give you? And she said, your signet, your bracelets, and your staff that's in your hand. And he gave it to her, and she came in, and he came in unto her, and she conceived by him. And she arose and went away and laid her veil from her and put on garments of her widowhood. And Judah said, the kid by the hand of his friend, the Adullamite, to receive his pledge from the woman's hand, but he found her not. Then he said to the men of that place, sorry.
Samara, 21 through 25, please. Samara? Okay, Brenda, 21 through 25, please.
Okay. Then he asked the men of that place, saying, where is the harlot who was openly on the roadside? And they said, there was no harlot in this place. So he returned to Judah and said, I cannot find her. Also, the men of that place said, there was no harlot in this place. Then Judah said, let her take that them for herself, lest we be shamed. For I sent this young goat, and you haven't found her. And it came to pass about 3 months after that Judah was told, saying, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot. Furthermore, she is with child by harlotry. So Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. When she was brought out, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, by the man to whom these belong, I am with child. And she said, please determine whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff.
Debbie has requested to be skipped over, so Vicki, will you finish the chapter, please?
And Yehudah examined and said, she has been more righteous than I, because I did not give her to Shelah, my son, and he never knew her again. And it came to be at the time for giving birth that, see, twins were in her womb. And it came to be when she was giving birth that the one put out his hand. And the midwife took a scarlet thread and bound it on his hand, saying, this one came out first. And it came to be as he drew back his hand that, see, his brother came out. And she said, how did you break through? This breach be upon you. So his name was called Peretz. And afterward, his brother came out who had the scarlet thread on his hand. So his name was called Zerah.
Aunt Mary, chapter 39, verses 1 through 5, please.
Joseph was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, the officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, brought him from the hands of the Ishmaelites, who had brought him down there. And Yahweh was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that Yahweh was with him, and that Yahweh made all that he did in to succeed in his hand. And Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. And he made him an overseer over his house, and he put everything that he had in his hand. And it was from the time that he made him overseer of his house and over all that he had that Yahweh blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of Yahweh was upon all that he had in the house and in the field.
And he left all that he had in Joseph's hand. He did not concern himself with anything except for the food which he ate. Joseph was well built and handsome. After these things, his master's wife set her eyes on Joseph, and she said, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, behold, my master doesn't know what is with me in the house, and he has put all that he has into my hand. No one is greater in this house than I am, and he has not kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? As she spoke to Joseph day by day, he didn't listen to her, to lie by her, or to be with her.
But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house were inside, that she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. And so it was when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, that she called to the men of her house and spoke to them, saying, see, he has brought in to us a Hebrew to mock us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened when he heard that I lifted my voice and cried out that he left his garment with me and fled out and went outside.
She kept his cloak beside her until his master came home. Then she told him this story. That Hebrew slave you brought us came to me to make sport of me. But as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. When his master heard the story, his wife told him, saying, this is how your slave treated me. He burned with anger. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. But while Joseph was there in the prison,
but the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison gave all the prisoners in the prison into Joseph's hand. And whatever they did there, he was the doer of it. The keeper of the prison did not look to anything under his hand, because Yahweh was with him, and whatever he did, Yahweh made it prosper.
And after these events, it came to be that the cupbearer and the baker of the sovereign of Mitzrayim sinned against their master, and that sovereign of Egypt, and the Pharaoh was wroth with his two officers, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. So he put them in a confinement in the house of the captain of the guard in the prison and the place where Joseph was prisoner. And the captain of the guard put Joseph in charge of them. He served them, and they were in confinement for some time. Then the cupbearer and the baker of the sovereign of Mitzrayim, who were confined in the prison, dreamed a dream, and both of them, each man's dream in one night, and each man's dream with its own interpretation.
And Sarah, verses 6 through 10, please.
And Joseph came in.
I'm sorry. It was Susan. Susan, we need to be orderly, but I messed that up. Susan?
Okay. When Joseph came to them in the morning and observed them, behold, they were dejected. And he asked Pharaoh's officials who were with him in confinement in his master's house, "Why are your faces so sad today?" Then they said to him, "We've had a dream, and there is no one to interpret it." Then Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to Yahweh? Tell it to me, please." So the chief cupbearer told his dream to Joseph and said to him, "In my dream, behold, there was a vine in front of me, and on the vine there were three branches, and it was budding. Its blossoms came out, and its clusters produced ripe grapes."
And Jimmy, verses 11 through 15, please.
Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup. And I gave the cup into Pharaoh's hand. Joseph said to him, "This is its interpretation. The three branches are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift your head and restore you to your office. You will give Pharaoh's cup into his hand in the way you did when you were his cupbearer. But remember, remember me when I will be well with you. And please show kindness to me and make mention of me to Pharaoh and bring me into his house. For indeed, I was stolen away out of the land of the Hebrews. And here also have I done nothing that they should put me into this dungeon."
And Glenn, 16 through, just finish the chapter, please.
The minister of the bakers saw that he had interpreted well, so he said to Joseph, "I, too, in my dream, behold, three wicker baskets were on my head, and in the uppermost basket were all kinds of Pharaoh's food, baker's handiwork, and the birds were eating them from the basket above my head." Yosef responded and said, "This is its interpretation. The three baskets are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift your head from you and hang you on a tree. Birds will eat your flesh from you." And it was on the third day, Pharaoh's birthday, and he made a feast for all of his servants, and he counted the chamberlain of the cupbearers and the chamberlain of the bakers among his servants. He restored the chamberlain of the cupbearers to his cupbearing, and he placed the cup on Pharaoh's palm. But he hanged the chamberlain of the bakers, just as Yosef had interpreted to them. Yet the chamberlain of the cupbearers did not remember Yosef, but he forgot him.
Thank you, everybody. I am sorry that I got distracted there a minute ago. Here is Rick to do our teaching.
Just a second here. Computers. Let's open with prayer and then we'll begin. Heavenly Father, we just thank you so much for the reading of your word. We give you praise and glory for it is from you. I ask that you would be with us during this time of study and let the words that come out of our mouth reflect your glory, and that they would be your words and not mine. In Yeshua's name, amen.
Can you put the headset on? It's very recording.
Okay. Okay. In this Torah portion, we find ourselves in the middle of a plot to kill the favorite son of Jacob. Often it is not the public things that a man does that reveals his heart. Rather, it is the one thing that he does that does behind when no one is looking at him. The character of the ten brothers were revealed when they went against their brother. In much the same way, it is not what we see with our eyes that is true. It is the things that are done behind the scenes. There we go. This is determined the outcome. The things that are done behind the scenes is determines the outcome of the war. What the deals are made behind closed doors, you know, the slaps on the back and the smoke-filled rooms, will determine the fate of the innocent. It goes on today in how to get rid of the image of God that we face from the face of the earth. If we want to ensure, see, they want to ensure that he does not return. There would be no believers on the earth for him to redeem the bride of Messiah. So in all this, the war is not just with flesh and blood, but it's also the spiritual war that we don't see. It's the things that are hidden from our eyes. If we were able to see just for a brief moment what is going behind the scenes would literally frighten us to death and we wouldn't be able to cope with it. Much of us would go insane. For the veil that is to hide from us the things that are spiritual is there for a reason to protect us and that we are to operate in this cloak that so that we can operate within the kingdom. For if we were able to see the things that were going on behind a cloak, we wouldn't be able to cope with it. In Revelation 12, 1 through 17, it reads, "And a great sign was seen in the heaven, a woman clad with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head was a crown of 12 stars. And being pregnant and cried out in labor, she gave to give birth to a," not big enough for me to see, "and to give birth. Another sign was seen in the heaven, and see a great fiery red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his heads. And his tail draws a third of the stars of the heavens and throws them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she bore a male child who was to shepherd the nation with an iron rod. And her child was caught up away to Elohim, to his throne. And the woman fled to the wilderness where she had a place prepared by Elohim to be nourished there 1,260 days. And there came to be fighting in heaven. Melech and his messengers fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his messengers fought, and they were not strong enough, nor was their place found in the heavens any longer. And the great dragon was thrown out of that serpent, of old, called the devil and Satan, who leads the world astray. He was thrown down to the earth, and his messengers were thrown out with him. And I heard a loud voice saying in the heavens, Now have come the deliverance and the power and the reign of our Elohim and the authority of his Messiah, the accuser of our brothers who accused them before our Elohim day and night has been thrown down. And they overcame him because of the blood of the Lamb and because of the word of their witness. They did not love their lives to death. Because of this, rejoice, O heavens, you who dwell in them. Woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has come down to and having great wrath, knowing that his time is little. And when the dragon saw that he was thrown down to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. And the woman was given 2 wings of a great eagle to fly in the wilderness to her place, where she would be nourished for a time, times, and a half a time. And from the presence of the serpent, and out of her
out of his mouth, the serpent spewed out water like a river. And the earth helped her, helped the woman, and the earth opened up his mouth and swallowed up the river, which a dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to fight the remnant of her seed, those guarding the commands of Elohim and possess the witness of Yeshua, Messiah. It is this the plot of the enemy to get rid of the followers of, and there will be no legal reason. So if the enemy is able to get rid of us all, there will be no legal reason for Messiah to return. Because without the bride, there would be no reason for the Messiah to come. This has been the plot from the very beginning, that if he couldn't get rid of the Messiah, which he tried on the cross, and he found out very quickly that it was the wrong choice that he did, that he would go after the believers, and he's been doing that ever since the cross. Every time we look at the major points in history, we look back and see that the persecution of the saints has been going on for time and time and time again. With war and with famine and with pestilence and persecution, burning at the stake, Nero had the Christians wrapped in cotton and burning them as torches. We were persecuted even from that time forward, even to today. Yes, the persecution took on different forms and methods, and it's by this, now it's by deceit. It's not so much in our face anymore, so we think, hey, everything's okay. Yeah, we're a little safe now. We're going to be all right. We'll make it to the end. We can sit in our easy chairs and not have to worry about what's going on around us. But the enemy has a different plan. He's relentless. He will go after us. He will tempt us. He will try us. He will make us doubt the calling that God has put on our lives. Yahweh has a different plan, and that was through Noah. So he was trying to get us under his control before the flood. It almost worked. Had it not been for 8 people who were still faithful and pure in God's sight, that the earth would have been destroyed and we wouldn't be having this discussion today. But Noah and his 3 children and his wife and their husband, or the husbands and their wives, the 8 of them were surviving the flood. They started over again. And had it not been for that, we'd all been doomed. And mankind wouldn't have a happy ever after story like we will see in Revelation when he comes back to rule and reign over the earth. It will not be happy for those who follow the enemy. Their sentence is sure. The enemy has plotted to get rid of the followers of Messiah will be because he wants no legal reason for his return. He was nearly successful with his plot to make all of humanity fall under his control. Yahweh had a different plan, and that was through Noah. This is the truism that the battle is not won in a tent, it is won on the battlefield. Anyone who thinks otherwise is totally wrong. Having served in the military, I realized this, that the true leadership is not sitting on the top of the ship, is those who are firing the cannons, those who are firing the missiles. It is those on the battlefield are actually winning the battle or losing it. We are on the battlefield for our very existence. And our battle is not with flesh and blood. It is with the enemy of our soul and with God's army. And when we realize that, we soon see that that the things that are in front of us is not really the reality of it, is what's going on behind the scenes. A true leader does not lead from the comfort of an easy chair, rather he leads the troops in the battle, and with them through the good times and the bleak times when it all seems lost. It reminds me of when Washington was a general in the Revolutionary War. He didn't lead from a tent. He was out there in the battlefield with them. He was riding his horse, commanding the troops, telling them which way to go, which way the enemy is weak. In fact, the battle at one point was so great, the enemy was firing directly at Washington, and they couldn't understand why he didn't fall. I mean, they were firing pretty close to him. And at the end of the battle, he took off his hat, rubbed out the shots that were in his hair, And they were just astonished. God had protected them through this battle. And in much the same way, every single battle that God wins, which is all of them that he fights, his people are protected. We don't see it all the time, and some of us fall, but they're often resurrected on the battlefield, in quoting the books like Jasher and other places, that they rise up and they fight again and again and again, and it just literally wears out the enemy. We don't know how this battle in the end times is going to take place, but the closer we get to it, the more we see that we need to depend upon him and everything that he does and listen to our leader. The 10 brothers of Joseph made an evil plot against their brother. The outcome was that they sold him for 20 pieces of silver. And it was not through them directly. It was through the Ishmaelites, to the other people that went along back to Egypt. Joseph was not a leader at that point, but he became a leader in Potiphar's house. He became a leader of all of Egypt. Potiphar was like a training ground for Joseph. His character was tested over and over again. It was at Potiphar's house that his character was tested through his Potiphar's wife. Was he stand for God when nobody was looking around? There was nobody around at this time that he was in Potiphar's house. He could have taken advantage of the situation and gave in to her. But he chose, how can I do this? My master has given me everything under his control. He's given me all of his household to guard and to make prosper in his hands. He doesn't even know what he has anymore. The only thing he cares about is what is in his stomach. He feeds him. It's all he cares about, what's in his stomach, and then he goes away and leaves everything entrusted to me. How can I sin against him, and how can I sin against God? The time of this battle didn't take place at that time. It happened beforehand when Joseph made a decision what he was going to do. Our testing doesn't start when the day of the testing is. It happens before then, and the decisions that we make during that time of the easy life that we have sometimes. Sometimes that these decisions happen that we make, and we're not certain as to which way to go, to the right or to the left, and God shows us go to the right or go straight on this course, and we don't understand it. But by learning to listen to him, when the battle starts, it will be too late to make a decision then. We need to make our decisions now on how we're going to serve our master, Yahweh. If we don't do it now, when the times are getting hard right now, or where we're standing on these positions as to who the Messiah is and when is his coming going to be and what we're going to do in the time of test. If we're not doing that now, then when the day of the testing comes, we're going to be lost. And we're not going to know what to do then. And hopefully, we'll remember, hopefully, that Yeshua is in control and we'll have peace and confidence in what he has done and not what we do. Yahweh always places his people in the right place at the right time. If you are not where Yahweh wants you, then everything you do will be mundane and not satisfying. I've seen people in the places I worked at that did not like where they worked at. They always ask for raises. They always think, well, my job is more important than this. I should be getting paid more. When I was in the military, people who complained the most were dissatisfied. They wanted more money. But it wasn't the money that was the issue. It was who they put their trust in. They didn't trust in God. They trusted in themselves, and they weren't happy in the position that they got. And if you notice, no matter where Joseph was, he never complained. Rather, he used what Yahweh had given him because Yahweh had prospered him in all that he did. He didn't complain that he was in the pit. Oh, yes, Jasher says he was crying and he was asking them to just have some reasoning and get him out of the pit. But they wouldn't even do that. They just totally disregarded him. And they more or less, they really wanted him dead. They didn't want to listen to him anymore in his dreams. Yeah, he was 17 years old. But the thing about it is, when they sold him into slavery, and they put it, Yahweh put him in Potiphar's house. So he puts us where he wants us at. Did you hear any time that while he was in Potiphar's house that he complained about the job that he had? I don't see it even in Joshua. I didn't see it in Genesis. I didn't see it in any of the writings I looked at. He listened to what God had to say to him. He just followed what God told him. He relied on what his dreams were. He relied on what God has told him, prepared him for. If we're not doing that now, when the times come that are going to be really hard, what are we going to do then? Everyone may seem to turn their backs on you. You need to know this, that Yahweh does not turn his back on those who love him. He is our rear guard. He is our front guard. He is with us when we go out. He is with us when we come back. He's better than any general or any admiral that I ever seen. Not only does he there before us, he's also there behind us. He's there with us in the thick of things. All we have to do is ask him for help, and he's going to be there with us if we love him and do what he says to do. But if we turn our backs on him, don't expect that he's going to be with us then. Oh, he may try to get us to come back, but there's going to reach a point in time where he's going to say, that's it. You're on your own. These are the decisions that you made. Now you have to live with them, and you have to pay the consequences for the decisions that you made. That's going to be a very sad place for us to be at. Yahweh blessed Joseph and showed him favor. No matter where you may find yourself, if you love him, he gives you exactly what you need at the time that you need it. We often get distracted by, well, this person has this and their ministry is this and I need this and I don't have that. And well, have you gone back to Yahweh and asked him what is going on and asked him to lead you in the place that he wants you to be at? Or are you just going on and just trying to get by? When the things do not go the way you think they should go, what do you do then? Do you draw closer and lean in closer to Yahweh, or do you run as Jonah did run? He spent 3 days and three nights in a big fish. Not a very good outcome for somebody who is a prophet of God. He knew exactly what God wanted to do with Nineveh. And yet, because of the animosity that the Jewish people had and the Ninevites had, he couldn't see how God could forgive these people. They were very wicked people. He says, oh, I know you, God. You're going to forgive them. He says, well, that's not for you to determine. They need to know the message. Your job is to deliver the message. Oh, I know better than you. I'm going to go the other way. I'm going to go this way instead of that way. I know where Nineveh is. I can get there in a day. But I'm going to go this way because I don't want to do what you want me to do. But because Jonah was the man of that God wanted to use, he was going to show him a lesson. He had a fish prepared for him, and he went into the fish for the fish's dinner instead of the fish being his dinner. So just because he found himself in the belly of a fish, it brought him something that he needed. He needed a reality check. What do you plan to do when you're in a position you can do nothing? People get in injuries. They get laid up. They get a broken ankle. They get a broken foot, a broken back. And yet that's the time they grow the most, because they learn to lean on Yeshua. And they learn to listen to what God has to say, because that's the time that they're listening now. And all along, he tried to get them to listen before that, but they weren't listening until that very minute. The fact is that we are at war and our enemy knows it. Why don't we know that we are at war? The enemy has put us to sleep. Wake up. Fire is at your door. You have but a few moments left to say your goodbye, or you can get up out of bed and fight your way out of that fire. And the only way you're going to do that is with Yeshua on your side, because other than that, your house is going to burn down around you and you may not even survive that. So even though you can just give up and just go back to wherever you came from, cower in a corner, or you can stand up and do what God called you to do, and be that man or woman that he's called you to be. According to Jasher, as we transition from this part where Joseph is sold into slavery. Judah went to the daughters of Shem for a wife for his eldest son. Her name was Tamar. Judah was the firstborn, destroyed, Judah's firstborn destroyed his seed. And that's why he died. Genesis doesn't really go into the details on this, but we do know that he died before he had any offspring. Then the secondborn went in, and he knew that if I do this, then I'm going to raise up seed for my brother, and I didn't like him. This is not really talked about too much. He didn't really want to do what he should have done. He liked her, but he didn't like her that much to where he was going to give seed to his brother, who was dead. So he died also. Now, Judah could have decided to do the right thing at this point, but he decided that, well, you know, my first two sons died because of their stupidity. Why should I want my third one to die for the same reason? I'm going to marry him off to somebody else. And Tamar, she can cool her heels a while, and I'm just going to go about my life and forget about her. Well, through a process of time, God had a different plan. God had him in a place where he lost his wife, and he mourned for her. And it took him a while, but he got through that. And then he decided he was going to go shear sheep with his friends. And then somebody came up to her and said, "Is not your father-in-law going to shear sheep?" I had to ask this question. But realizing that she was of the grandchild of Shem, the descendant of Eber, was in the same line as his father, Isaac. There was something that was about that whole situation that clicked in my head. Just because things don't always work out the way we think they should work out, God has a plan. He's not going to go back and away from it. He's going to guide us through it, whether we want to or not, whether we want to be part of it or not. He's either going to use us or he's going to use somebody else. But because Tamar was of the descendant of Shem, who was Melchizedek, the line of Messiah had to be established through the line of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, down to Judah and Tamar. And if you notice something too, that never is mentioned again after this. But Judah and Tamar are mentioned. And then in fact, the Prezites, Prez means to break forth, to bust forward, to come out quickly. He was the firstborn. It's mentioned a couple different times, the Prezites and Zerites, the brothers. These are mentioned over and over again throughout the scriptures. Prezites, they had an inheritance in the kingdom. Had it not been for Tamar's persistence, it would have been a hollow kingdom because there wouldn't have been any descendants after that. But because she was persevered in this, because she was knowing what God wanted her to do, it's not said so explicitly in Jasher or in Genesis or any place I've read at, but she was the one that God wanted to use. He raised up Ruth also. And Ruth is part of the genealogy of Messiah, Yeshua. Just because you have a low position in life does not necessarily mean that's a low position in God's kingdom. You must listen to what he says, do what he says when he says it. It could very well be just as Jacob's own mother guiding him along on what God had already told her to do. That he said to her that the younger will be in over the oldest. Jacob over Esau. And Esau was going to be subservient to Jacob. Where Jacob's always painted in a bad light as a deceiver, it could have very well been mentioned that did Tamar also deceive Judah? Or did Judah fail in his mission that God gave him? He failed on so many different occasions. He could have manned up and done the right thing all along, but he didn't do it. Yes, he was responsible for allowing them not to kill Joseph. Again, Joseph, if he had died during that time, where would Israel be at that, after that? They would have died, and the whole world would have died in the famine. Something to think about when we think about how all these things fit together. Just because, like I said before, you have a low position does not necessarily mean you're going to stay there. God elevates those who will elevate, and he brings down those who will bring down. America was brought up because of what they did at the very beginning. They dedicated the country into God. And yet look at where we're at today. Not such a good place. We abandon God on every single corner, every single place. We've blotted out his name from all public records just about. If they could do away with all of us, they would do it. And they're working on it, believe you me. And we need to be vigilant in prayer and asking God what to do at this time and this hour. So we can be just like Tamar, just like Joseph. Be that man, be that woman that God's called you to be. And don't shrink back from when he says, now the battle's in your front door. What are you going to do? Are you going to depend upon me? Or are you going to back off and go hiding in the corner somewhere, hoping that somebody else will come deliver you? But you, he may be having you deliver your family, your town, your city, in prayer and supplication and fasting and weeping for those people. Because he loves us all, but we choose the wrong path almost all the time. Look at how many times Judah went back and forth and back and forth. He could have stood up against Reuben and those. Reuben went back, tried to get Joseph, but he was already gone. He walked away. Judah, in this point, he walked away. But God wasn't finished with Judah. He's not mentioned very much after this. But through Judah came the Messiah. Through Tamar's persistence in knowing what she had to do, it brought forth the Messiah years and years later. Tamar didn't know the part that she played. Judah definitely didn't know the part he played. But if you look back in the genealogy of things, Tamar and Ruth are in that family line of Yeshua because they were bold enough to do what God required them to do. And where do you fit in all this? Where does he called you to do? What he's called you to do, and where has he called you to be at? And if he's called you to be somewhere else other than where you're at right now, why are you still there? Why are you still in that town? Or why are you still in that group? If he's called you out of that, why are you still there? You need to ask yourself and ask God, what can you do? If Tamar wasn't persistent, the line of Yeshua would have taken a whole different route. Just because Judah's character was not suitable, in the end, Tamar's firstborn Perez, and without him there, would have had no Boaz. Because through Tamar came Boaz, and Boaz brought in Ruth, and Ruth brought in their descendant, and then David. King David, the ruddy little guy who was just a sheep herder. He brought him in the picture because he was a man after God's own heart. But he had, again, he persisted in doing what God called him to do, to be the king of Israel. He didn't know how to be king. He knew how to lead sheep. But you don't ever hear him complain about that. So you would have no Boaz, David, nor Solomon. We would not know where we would fit into the mosaic. We do not know where we fit in the mosaic of life, of the kingdom. And without you, there would be a big hole and an empty place where you should be. But as it is, we're all here for the same reason, to serve our living King, Yeshua. And that's all I have.
Well, thank you, Rick. That was good, and it was a good reminder that we all need to be aware of being in our place is very important because that's the will of Yahweh, and if we don't do our job, then something is going to get awry. Does anybody have a question or comment about this Torah portion? And it can be on anything that's, you know, in the teaching or not in the teaching. Well, until somebody raises their hand, I have this comment to make. One of the facts of this that we get from the book of Jasher is that Tamar was in the line of Melchizedek. And so think about this. Of all the women in Yeshua's lineage, Tamar is the one that preserved in his physical genealogy his connection to be Melchizedek. He was not a Levite, but he was from the line of Melchizedek. He was from that heavenly order. And so that was Tamar's role, was to preserve the Melchizedek line so that Yeshua could come some 4,000 years later, 3,800 years later or so, and you know, fulfill all the promises of salvation and his sacrifice and all, and have legal, be he could be legally, physically in the line of Melchizedek. Anybody have another comment or question?
Yeah, in one of my my books, it says that he raised the family with Tamar, because the one Bible says that he didn't know her again, like he had nothing to do with Tamar, but wasn't it his responsibility to raise that child along with her?
Yeah, but what it says there is he didn't have sex with her again, but you know, you can help to raise a child without having to have sex with the mother.
Oh, is that all it was saying? Okay.
Yes. I don't know if it was Susan or Glenn first, but I'm going to call on Susan.
You know, one thing that I really don't know, I haven't read Jasher to know, you know, what Tamar was thinking, but what came to mind is this idea of justice, justice you shall pursue. And I think what really struck me is that even if she didn't know the fullness of what was going on, because Judah was, he was a clod still at this point in time. I mean, it hadn't been revealed that he was going to redeem himself, right? But anyway, she knew what was just, and he was not being just with her. And, you know, it's taken me a long time to understand or even be, you know, attracted to law and how it all works. But this idea of justice starts from the time we're born, in terms of we understand when we have, when something has not been done right to us. And it's very deep. It's deeper than perhaps we first realized, this idea. So I just think she persisted for the sake of justice. Now, I mean, I'm not saying that that's the only thing, but I just think that if we persist for things that we know are just, who knows what kind of line fulfillment, and maybe nothing as big as Tamar, but he operates through that line of justice.
Yes, and to this point, we have three notable women in the line of Yeshua who were all kingdom-minded and did what was necessary. That was Sarah, Rebecca, and now Tamar. Glenn?
Shabbat shalom. I was just going to mention that in chapter 37, and we're looking down at verse 15, where it talks about a man discovered Yosef when Yosef was following his dad's orders and looking for his brothers to see if they were at peace. Yes, I see. A man discovered Yosef, and he was as he lost his way or went astray in the field, and the man asked him, "What do you seek?" And he said, "My brothers do I seek. Tell me, please, where are they? Where are they pasturing? Where are they shepherding?" And the man told him where to go, Dotan. Well, I was wondering, is the man the same one that Yaakov wrestled with all night? Is it Yeshua that came in the flesh there to guide him and make sure he gets to where he eventually wants him? And I looked up that word Dotan. The place where they were shepherding in Hebrew, it has some different meanings like faith, belief, and gospel. So this man sent him on to belief. Anyway, that's all.
Yeah, that's good. And I had also read somewhere years ago that Dotan also means two wells. We've been reading in Genesis stories about wells and how important the wells are as symbolism for our faith. And now here we read about two wells. Well, you know, Joseph becomes a well and the other brothers become a well. They get split. So maybe there's some connection there too.
And then there's also the word pit. There's two pits because he gets put in a pit by his brothers. And then then Potiphar puts him in another pit, a dungeon, a prison.
Yes. Yes. Hillary.
Oh, that's interesting. I love the analogy between pits and wells of water, because he was put in a dry pit. And then he became a well of water, of living water. The other thing that kind of comes to my mind is that the scripture that all things work together for good to those who love God and are called according to his purpose. All these stories seem to have that two-edged sword of difficulty turning into blessing. In Joseph's story, in Tamar's story, all the stories, including our own. That's it for me.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good point. Julianne.
Shabbat Shalom. I would like to share a quick little story, if I may, about last Sabbath. After Sabbath service, after your lecture, and then I go to Sabbath service, me and my best friend, who owns a mobile grooming dog, well, we helped this homeless woman. And the day before, she had feces all over her. She could barely talk. And we had called an ambulance to take her to the hospital. So we thought, oh, maybe we could feed her. And we prayed before we did this because it was about, we didn't know if she was going to let loose. She didn't have people around her. And we just felt compelled to have her go to the hospital, hoping she'd get a warm meal and a bath, because we tried to bathe her in the grooming van the day before. So after service, we go, oh, we'll go check on her at the hospital. So we go to the hospital. They had released this poor woman who could barely speak 5 hours after she had been admitted. So I was just destroyed, because I said, oh my God, what am I going to do? This woman is in a totally different part of town. We just ruined this woman's life and where she's supposed to be. So I started doubting myself. But then I remembered, stay in faith, stay in prayer, and stay in thanksgiving. So we ran to get something to eat out of town where we live, and we go, well, we're just going to drive around until we find her. I go, I need a coffee. So we drive through a coffee place, and I look up in despair, and who do I see walking along the sidewalk, dragging a blanket, confused? Is this woman? We were so overjoyed. I just knew the Lord. I kept the faith. So we take her, and we don't know what to do with her. We were going to bathe her in the local pool or something, because they still didn't bathe her. So we just started praying again. We drove her 30 minutes out to this place in Phoenix. It looks like LA with all the homeless. And turns out she had been there many, many, many years before. So they were able to give her a shower. She took like a 2-hour shower. And she had been homeless for at least, I think, 10 years. but she had been in and out. And I just knew that the Lord worked in a very different way. Even though I was overcome by fear and disappointment and worry, he worked out in the end. And I was just so overjoyed. So I just wanted to share with people that when you there's chaos and turmoil, to keep your faith, remain in prayer and in thanksgiving, and he will always show up.
Amen. That's a good story.
Wow, what a great story.
Yeah. Jimmy.
Yes, I have a completely different type of question, and this is more personal than for anyone else, but I don't know. I have a comprehensive etymological dictionary of the Hebrew language for readers of English, Matthew. Now, when I attempt to use it, say the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, Aleph, but there's nothing in parentheses to tell me what is the meaning of the word that they're trying to describe. So I'm wondering, do you know of another source that I could use to help me along with my, Hebrew language?
Well, go ahead, Rick.
One of the sources I use quite a bit is Jeff Brenner's work. He's got a website. It's very good. It's called Mechanical Translation. So that's a good way of getting you used to the words. That's about all.
Hillary?
Yeah, I use Klein's Etymological Dictionary. It's the best one I've found, and I sort of use it along with Strong's, but Strong's has its limitations, and this one goes, I love this one, Klein's, Clines.
Yeah, that's the one I have. But as I said, Hillary, I am stumped. You know, I just don't understand what word they're trying to tell me, describing. So you may have a little more background, a better background than I do, Hebraically. So I am struggling like hell, you know.
Oh, and then there's Erectology, Eric Bissell. And
what is it?
You could probably even contact him or email him. He has a show on YouTube, and he teaches Paleolithic Hebrew.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hi, Elf.
I have talked a lot about eSword. It's a free source, and in this source, you download it to your laptop, and in here I have Strong's, and I have Brown Driver Briggs, and I have AHLB, which is the Ancient Hebrew Lexicon, and this is also the Greek Concordance, and I have an interlinear, and all of these things, you have to use them together. You have to look at them all, because they all, while they do have overlaps, sometimes they will give you additional information. I think it's a mistake to stick with just one source when we're studying the Hebrew or the Greek. Now, that's just my opinion. Susan, you had your hand up, and then I think Glenn did too.
Yes, I just sent him a text on one that I use that it's an etymological dictionary by Matiyahu Clark. And it's very interesting because he's through studies of, ancient studies. Anyway, the letters that are used, you know, sometimes are swapped out. And there's just a fascinating idea that he introduces. But I find it very useful, too. So, but I chatted him for it. So.
Okay, thank you. And Glenn?
I use English Hebrew dictionaries first and foremost, but I recently bought another guy named Klein's book. Ernest Klein is a Holocaust survivor, and he spells his name K-L-E-I-N. It's a comprehensive etymological dictionary of the Hebrew language for readers of English, and It's fascinating, really good one. And anyway, I wanted to say something else about the Tamar Yehuda chapter 38. In verse 15, Judah saw her and thought her to be a zona, which is a Hebrew word for prostitute or harlot, because she covered her face. And then we go on to verses 21. And verses 21, twice instead of zona, the word for harlot, it's actually the word kadosh, kadasha. It's, comes from kadosh, meaning set apart or holy and sanctified, betrothed. And so some of the translations still say harlot there or prostitute, but that isn't what the Hebrew word is. I think somebody's muted.
Oh yeah, I am muted. Thank you, Glenn. I was just talking along. Okay. The Kadosh Kedoshah is a set apart harlot. It's a temple priest or priestess. I mean, a temple woman who acts as a priestess in the Canaanite temples. So that's what that is. So I don't know why Judah didn't know the difference, why he used one word and then used another word later on, but in my opinion, it was Yahweh's way of preserving Tamar's identity. Rick?
Some has noted the first mention was the Judah assumed that she was a prostitute, and then his friend went and searched for her and called her the priestess. So.
Yeah, so Judah changed the word he used with the Adulamite friend that he sent out. So I don't know why that happened. That was kind of an oddity that I've never understood. Anybody else? Okay, well, then let's go on to the Haftarah, which is Amos chapter 2, starting at verse 6. So Amos 2, verse 6, and it is Douglas's turn to read. So Douglas, would you read verses 6 through 10, please? That's Amos 2, 6 through 10.
Thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Israel and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof. Because they sold the righteous for silver and the poor for a pair of shoes, that pant after the dust of the earth on the head of the poor and turn aside the way of the meek. And a man and his father will go in unto the same maid to profane my holy name. And they lay themselves down upon clothes laid to pledge by every altar, and they drink the wine of the condemned in the house of their God. Yet destroyed I the Amorite before them, whose height was like the height of the cedars, and he was strong as the oaks. Yet I destroyed his fruit from above and his roots from beneath. Also, I brought you up from the land of Egypt and led you 40 years through the wilderness to possess the land of the Amorite.
Thank you. Sarah, verses 11 through 16, just finish the chapter, please.
I raised up some of your sons as prophets, and some of your young men as Nazarites. Is it not so, O you children of Israel, says the Lord? But you gave the Nazarites wine to drink and commanded the prophets, saying, do not prophesy. Beyond, I am weighed down by you. Behold, I am weighed down by you. As a cart full of sheaves is weighed down, therefore flight shall perish from the swift, and the strong shall not strengthen his power, nor shall the mighty deliver himself. He shall not stand who handles the bow. The swift of foot shall not escape, nor shall he who rides a horse deliver himself. The most courageous men of might shall flee naked in that day, says the Lord.
And Hillary, would you just read the rest of the Haftarah? It is Amos 3, starting at verse 1 through 8.
Yes. Hear this word that Yahweh has spoken against you, O children of Yasharel, against the whole family which I brought up from the land of Mitzrayim, saying, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. Therefore I'll punish you for the Aleph Tav of your iniquities. Can two walk together except they agree? Will a lion roar in the forest when he has no prey? Will a young lion cry out of his den if he's taken nothing? Can a bird fall in the snare upon the earth where no gin is for him? Shall one take up a snare from the earth and have nothing at all? Shall a shofar be blown the city and the city and the people not afraid? Shall there be evil in the city and Yahweh has not done it? Surely Adonai Yahuwah will do nothing, but he reveals the secret unto his servants of prophets. The lion has roared, who will not fear? Adonai Yahweh has spoken, who can but prophesy?
Thank you.
Okay.
Any comments or questions about this? Well, certainly it is true that what Yahweh is doing now, since having chosen Jacob to be the father of the nation Israel. You know, Abram was given to be a father of many nations. Isaac was given the same promise, and so was Jacob. But Jacob got an honor that Abraham and Isaac did not get, and that was to be the forefather and the father of Israel, the nation. He got that name put on him. And so now, here in Amos 3:1, hear this word that Yahweh has spoken against you, children of Israel, against the whole family which I brought up out of the land of Egypt. What he's talking about here is that the whole history of the earth has to do, and it centers around Israel. Israel is the foremost nation of the earth. And yet look what the brothers of Joseph did right out of the gate. I mean, we have this example of their treachery against their own brethren. This is something that Yeshua, when he was on the earth, said, you know, this is going to continue. Brothers will turn on brothers. You know, when I was a child in church, I thought, oh, how awful that that's going to happen. But, you know, you're a little naive as a child. But I can tell you that the habit of Israelites is just this kind of treachery. And it's the same treachery that Amos here is speaking about in the Haftarah. Hillary, did you have a comment?
No, I just hadn't shut off my mic.
Ah,
after
okay.
Reading, sorry.
Okay. Does anybody have a comment? Wow. Okay. Well, let's go to the Brit Hadashah portion, which is Matthew chapter 1, verses 1 through 6. Matthew 1, 1 through 6. We'll go to that one. And this time it is, I'm going to go to Vicki. Vicki, will you read Matthew 1:1-6. Just read the whole thing.
The book of the genealogy of Yeshua HaMashiach, ben of David, ben of Abraham. Abraham brought forth Yitzchak, and Yitzchak brought forth Jacob. And Jacob brought forth Yehudah and his brothers. And Yehudah brought forth Peretz and Zerah by Tamar, and Peretz brought forth Hezron, and Hezron brought forth Ram. And Ram brought forth Aminadab, and Aminadab brought forth Nashon. And Nashon brought forth Salmon. And Salmon brought forth Boaz by Rahab. And Boaz brought forth Obed by Ruth, and Obed brought forth Yishai. And Yishai brought forth David, the sovereign, and David, the sovereign, brought forth Shelomo by Uriah's wife. One more, or was that?
No, that was it.
Okay.
That was it.
Okay, thank you.
So here we have an interesting thing, and maybe somebody has an explanation for this, because the first woman mentioned in Matthew's genealogy is Tamar. Now, we also have the mention of Rahab and Ruth later on, but, you know, you would think that Sarah and Rebecca would have been mentioned in this genealogy, and maybe even Leah, because she's the mother of Judah. But no, the first one is Tamar. So I don't understand what the importance of Tamar is over Sarah and Rebecca and even Leah in this account. Does anybody have an opinion or a comment about that?
Oh, yeah, it's fine.
I might. Judah gave Tamar his signet, his bracelet, and his cord, which are representative of the authority, the power, and the covenant. And I don't know if that was just by happenstance. I tend to believe it wasn't, but there is a definite purpose and reason behind he gave those things to Tamar as a pledge, because not only it went to the substitute for a kid for the, you know, or basically earnest money or earnest for a promise of a kid, but it certainly carried a certain authority and power and covenantal representation.
Okay. Well, you know what has just come to my mind is that Tamar, Rahab, and Ruth are not in the line of the family. Abraham married a woman from his family. Isaac married a woman from his family. And Jacob married women from his family. But then we have Judah, who does not marry or have a children by somebody in his family, in that same family line, although Tamar is, in the Shem line. She's still not in the same line, and neither is Rahab or Ruth in the line that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, where they got their wives. Rick?
Something came to mind when you said about the signet ring, was that Judah just gave this answer, this reply about the signet ring, the cord, and the staff. Oh, well, let her have it. You know, what is it to me? He was even negating the thing that gave him authority to sign off on documents and things like that to somebody he thought was a prostitute. He was eager to give it away because he didn't want to spend the time looking for her. And yet Yahweh worked it out that he found out that he was a cad, and his character wasn't all that noble. And in fact, the second point I had was about Ruth and also Tamar being mentioned here, was that, again, they're outside of it, and it brings in that anyone who is wanting to obey what God has set up for his kingdom can come in and they are brought in as true Israelites. This gives us hope and promise that even though we're outside of, well, I'm not a Jew, I'm not this, I don't know what tribe I'm in, he gave us a way in if we just want to obey his kingdom laws.
And I'm glad that you said all that, because you know what it made me understand is that the whore of Mystery Babylon, Judah, gave him his authority over to who one he thought was a whore, and Judah is giving today his authority over to whoredom, to a whore. Yes. So Yako said he got the same thing. With Hillary and then D.
Kind of reminds me of Esau. Same pattern, same behavior.
Yeah. A different manner, but basically the same attitude. Go ahead, D.
Well, Ruth and Tamar both had to press through for the kinsman redeemer law. And so but all three of them had to go above and beyond just being like an average wife that maybe just couldn't have children. I mean, the thing is that they had to press through. They had to go above and beyond and press through all kinds of difficulties and potential dangers. You know, Tamar could have, if she hadn't had the proof, she could have been burned. Ruth went into a very uncomfortable situation where she was, she could have been very hated for being from Moab, and the Lord raised up Boaz to protect her. And so they had to press through. Even Naomi said, go back. You really don't want to come here. You really don't want to do this. And she had to press through. And Rahab, she had to press through and hide the spies and help the enemy when she knew that it was the right thing. So that's my 2 cents.
No, that's a good 2 cents. And it makes sense. It ties in with what Rick said, that, you know, look, the line of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, those people are of a line. But if you are called by Yahweh and you are not within that line, but you're called by Yahweh, you have to prove yourself. The line of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob have to prove themselves by keeping the law, which they refused to do. But these women went over and above what was necessary in order to just go and be converted to being an Israelite and keeping the law. They pressed in and they fulfilled their calling. And that goes back with what Rick was saying. If you are called, stick to your calling. Fulfill it. Julianne.
It kind of reminds me of the Kings and Chronicles, the Jeremiah study. Over and over again, we're given examples of those that followed the law and those that didn't. And that's what Tamar reminds me of. She knew what was right. She knew she had to press through. And it is also reflective in the walk that we do every day, is knowing the Torah and applying it. And that's how we decipher who teaches us and who doesn't. And even though it may be rough or tough with those around us, or a service you go to, is to recognize and to know the law so that you can apply it every single way. And when you do know it, hold strong, even though people fall away from you. And she was brought low because the law wasn't fallen. And it kind of reminds me of Yeshua when he was brought low and hung on a cross. He knew what was right. He knew what he had to do. So he had to suffer for us. And so being brought low, he's saved us all. So I kind of have to remember that too when I don't feel so great.
Okay, good comment. Anybody else? Susan.
So growing up in the church, I always remember hearing the Gentile bride, the Gentile bride. You know, and it's funny, but after being in this walk, I began to get kind of that idea. And here we have it kind of in this lineage line. And again, it is for those that pursue and push and know what's right. And that's what they want. And, you know, he says that we can seek him. And if we seek him with all of our heart, he will allow himself to be found. So I think that is the spirit of at least some of these women. Anyway, the Gentile bride is, I know that's a church concept, but at the same time, there's a reason why it wound up being a concept. And I think there's other things that I don't fully understand concerning that. And if you have any understanding behind that, if you could kind of tell me what that might be. I just think it's an interesting thing.
Thank you. Well, the reference is, as you said, it's a bride that comes not just from the line of Jacob physically. She now is coming from every tribe on earth, every family, every place where Yahweh said that this bride would come from. And so she's referred to as a Gentile bride, but I want to clear up, and you know this, you can't be an Israelite and a Gentile at the same time. So Tamar actually became an Israelite. She was from the line of Shem, but her involvement with Judah now made her an Israelite. Rahab and Ruth, the same thing. They went from being what they were to being an Israelite. So while they come from being Gentile, they have converted to being Israel. So I understand what you're saying and what the church says. And it's kind of one of those conundrums, you know. It does have a dual meaning there. Dee?
Well, also in verse 6, it does not name Bathsheba by name in my translation. It says her of Uriah. And for Solomon, and I'm pondering, she wasn't mentioned by name because maybe because it wasn't her choice initially to be, and it was initially from sin that she entered into this. However, one thing that she did do is she stood up at the end with David and said, you know, she made sure that Solomon was in the line. And so she did stand up at the end for him to be in the line and to, as David had said. So there's that.
Yes, and let's also remember that the line of Solomon ended, and that he became the Joseph, Mary's husband, became came from the line of Solomon, and that's one of the reasons why the line of Solomon is not the correct line for the Messiah to come through. Mary, who is from the line of Nathan. Go ahead, Dee.
Oh, no, I'm just listening. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Anybody else have a comment on this part of the Haftarah before we go on to the next part, which is chapter 16, or no, verses 16 through 25. Anybody else have another comment? Glenn.
I have a comment about a word that isn't in the Hebrew language and it isn't in the Greek language. The term Gentile is neither a word in Hebrew nor Greek. It's a made-up word by the Latin-speaking conquerors of the land of Israel that destroyed Jerusalem in 70 Common Era. And I believe those Romans were anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, anti-Yahweh, and they, in my opinion, made the word up. Because the word in Hebrew that they are using is goyim, goy or goyim, which just means nations. And Yahweh himself calls his people Israel goy, his goy, his goyim. And we know that the Romans changed the name of Israel to Palestinia, and they changed the name of Jerusalem to Aioli Capitolina. We know that they did these things, but for some reason we have this mindset that there's this group of people called Gentiles that is, in my opinion, any Bible that uses the word Gentile, they did not translate from original Hebrew. They translated through Latin, through the Roman system. And, it's just a pet peeve I have. I do not like the word because it's not a word in the original Bible. It's a made-up word.
Okay, Yako?
This, Glenn, that's a very good point because a lot of people don't realize this. We call ourselves Hebrew roots of Christianity for one reason only. It means that everything we believe is in the five books of Moses. And the term Gentile was defined when Jacob blessed Ephraim and Manasseh, and he crossed his hands, and he called Ephraim, he said, because I will call you from the nations. And that is exactly the whole New Testament referring to God's people scattered in the nations being called back into covenant. And that's what this whole term that you described, it comes down to, which is really good.
Thank you. All right, anybody else before we read the last part of this? Okay, Dee, would you start at Matthew 1:16 and read through verse 20, please?
Yes. So 1:16 through 20?
Yes.
And Jacob begat Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Yeshua, who is called Messiah. So all the generations from Abraham, David, to David are 14 generations. And from David until the carrying away into Babylon are 14 generations. And from the carrying away into Babylon unto Messiah are 14 generations. Now the birth of Yeshua Messiah was on this wise. When as his mother Mary was espoused to Joseph before they came together, she was found with child of the Holy Spirit. Then Joseph, her husband, being a just man and not willing to make her a public example, was minded to put her away privately. But while he thought on these things, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a dream, saying, Joseph, thou son of David, fear not to take unto thee Mary thy wife, for that which is conceived in her is of the Holy Spirit, and she shall bring forth a son. I'm sorry.
Okay, Brenda, 21 through 25, please.
And she will bring forth a son, and you shall call his name Yeshua, for he will save his people from their sins. So all this was done that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, Behold, the virgin shall be with child and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which is translated God with us. Then Joseph, being aroused from sleep, did as the angel of the Lord commanded him, and took her as his wife, and did not know her,
till she had brought forth her firstborn son and called his name Yeshua.
Okay, thank you. My comment on this is just this. In Genesis, we have Jacob becoming the father of Joseph. And that's the right line. It says in 1 Chronicles 5:1 that Judah prevailed, but the birthright belongs to Joseph. So Jacob was the father of Joseph in Genesis, but here we have Jacob becoming the father of Joseph, and he's now from the wrong line, the one that is not going to bring forth the Messiah in the end of days. I just found that interesting. Anybody else? Okay.
I'm sorry. Can you just repeat that, Kim?
Okay. Jacob became the father of Joseph in Genesis. The birthright was Joseph's. He was chosen by Jacob. He was going to become, he was given the birthright. That's what that coat of many colors was the indicator of. He had been chosen to lead the family. And so he was of the right line. But now we have this one that's from Solomon that we know he's not going to bring the Messiah. He's going to bring the Antichrist. And in that line is another Jacob who fathers a Joseph, who became the husband of Mary. But it was Mary who was the important person here. She brought the Messiah through the correct line, through the line of Nathan.
Right. Thank you.
You're welcome. Anybody else? Yeah. Okay.
Just a thought occurred to me. That here we have, at the beginning of this story, Joseph and his, and then Tamar and Judah and all that. So here we have at the end of this that we have Yeshua coming through Miriam or Mary, and Tamar brings forth the line of the Melchizedek, and here we have Miriam bringing forth the Messiah, who is the beginning and the end of Melchizedek line. So, Miriam's also part of that line through Nathan. Yeah. Goes all the way back. You can trace it all the way back to Tamar. So without these people in this lineage, I often remark that when I was looking through during a Sukkot, my family heritage, a certain person, and I found out through Avitainu that this person's family was of a Jewish descent. And had that person not been in my lineage, my great-grandmother, my grandmother, and my father would not be here, and neither would I. You don't know how important you are until we look backwards in history to see how all these pieces fit together. When we're driving down the road, we see what's ahead of us. But sometimes the important thing is what's behind us, this great big semi who's about ready to rear-end us. And if we're not looking behind us as well as looking in front of us, we could get very seriously injured or dead. So Yahweh takes care of that. He is the front guard and the rear guard, and he's with us in the passenger seat, and he should be in the driver's seat. Because if he's not, then we're going, our life is going the wrong direction.
I'm going back and forth if I want to explain this. The mainstream teaching out there is that Miriam is in the genealogy of Matthew. Now, if you read at the end, it will says 14 generations till David, 14 generations till the exile to Babylon, and then 14 generations to Yeshua. And then the argument is if you count them, you only get 13 when you get to Yeshua. Then they add Yeshua to the line with the excuse that Joseph was Mary's caretaker, so he was her stepfather, and then he married her. That sounds good, except that if you go through the king study, it tells you when you get to Jehoiakim. What happened with King Jehoiakim, Jeremiah warned him and said, if you do not change your ways, God is going to cut you off from the line and none of your descendants will ever sit on the throne again. So Jehoiakim ignored Jeremiah through that letter that it was said in, into the fire. Now, if you read through this genealogy, you will not find the King Jehoiakim in there. Now, if you add him back in there where he belongs, Yeshua is number 15 and not number 14.
And Mary, did you have a comment?
Yes, I think I was reading in the Lost Books of the Bible that Miriam's mother's name was Anna, and that when she was about the age of Samuel, she was raised in the temple like Samuel was. Had you ever heard that?
No.
And I've also got an interesting website, MennoniteIsrael.org, that may... It sounds like the Mennonite are connected to Israel as well, which is kind of my background.
Ah, Amish. You're a Mennonite.
My grandparents on both sides were Amish, and it turned out that my parents were cousins. But they met over here. They're from Canada, and they met here in New York State. So.
Wow, interesting.
All my 60 cousins were fourth cousins. They didn't know it, but...
Oh, wow. Anybody else before we close the meeting? Hillary.
No, this could really throw some mud in the waters. Dr. Pigeon has, Stephen Pigeon from Sefer Publishing, has some teachings, recent teachings on this. And he proposes that Joseph of Arimathea was Mary, the Virgin Mary, Mary's husband Joseph's father. And then when Joseph, her husband, died, she came under, she went back under the protection of Joseph of Arimathea, the grandfather. I haven't worked it all out, and I've been meaning to sit down and really analyze what he's saying, but I'll just throw it out there.
Okay, that was the false teaching I was referring to. That's the main media teaching out there. Every teacher is trying to justify that. It comes from the Aramaic text, where the Aramaeans didn't understand this either. So they used a word that means caretaker or stepfather. Now I had to shout out to Yahweh and tell him, but why is there a false teaching out there? Why is, because in the prophets it's clear. Yeshua cannot be the king if he's from the line of Jehoiakim, because Jehoiakim's line is cut out. And the answer I got from him, well, what was impressed upon me is read through the king's names. If you add the king Jehoiakim before Jehoiachin, that teaching falls through the floor about the 14 genealogies, because they count from the Babylonian exile to Yeshua, 13 generations. Then they add Yeshua as the 14th, and they justify it by speaking about Joseph being the father of Miriam and then marrying her.
Thank you.
Okay, Brenda.
Well, a long time ago, I had heard something about verse 13. Zerubbabel begot Abihud. Abihud begot Abner. Abner begot Eliakim, and Eliakim begot Azor. And that's how you get that other one in there. But for some reason, they took Abner out. I don't know the reason for that. I did not write that down. But I was going to go back to the Torah portion, chapter 39. I have a question, and maybe one of you have heard this. Last night we went to a Bible study, and the lady said that when Joseph was in, oh yeah, it was two nights ago, sorry. When Joseph was in the house with the wife all by himself, it's because there was some kind of a
the winter solstice was happening, and all the men were at that place praying, and that's why the wife was by herself, and she could come on to Joseph like that. But then later on it says that she called the men of her house, and they came. So I don't know how true this is, but she said the winter solstice was December 25th when fornication goes on, and it had to do with Nimrod, Ra, Ishtar, and I was wondering if anybody else had ever heard that teaching before. If I just need a second witness.
I have not heard that teaching, but the winter solstice has not ever been fixed as December 25th until Christianity came along. It is the changing of the seasons, and that usually happens around the 21st or the 22nd of the month. And so I'm not sure why the Catholic Church made December 25th the day, but if you look at the solstice, that's not when it happens on that day. And these people were not, they didn't have calendars. They looked at the sun and the moon, and they figured out what was going on from what the sun and the moon did, and then they did their rituals according to that. So I don't know anything about what was going on in Potiphar's religion at that time. So I don't know. The fact that the other men were in the house tells me that there's something kind of awry there, but I don't know what it is, Brenda, honestly. Anybody else have an idea?
I would like to share with you all that there's a 7-hour, 40-minute video by a Chinese retired sociology teacher, and he has incredible thing about sun worship, and I'm pretty sure that is covered in it. And it's got an interesting title which might throw some people off, but it's called, he did it in 2017, and so it was How U.S. President Donald Trump Could Help Pope Francis to Rule the, quote, Global World, unquote. So it's just got so much. It's even got stuff about the flat earth and the fact that the sun goes around the earth as opposed to us thinking that we're on a spinning ball. It's really, that's around 5 hours into it where it's fascinating information. What they can't do without television, I wonder what they would have done if they hadn't invented the television. Because, you know, there's just so much that you can do with pictures. Like you were saying, images, you know.
Yeah, you know, we don't study the ways of other gods. They're mentioned in the Bible, and of course, from that viewpoint, we do. But also, we don't subscribe to or debate flat earth here. So that has become a religion in and of itself. Just like other sciences, pseudosciences, and, you know, people's nasty business that they do all become religion, and they turn into having rituals and all of that. So we just don't follow that kind of stuff. We don't do that stuff. Anybody else? Douglas.
I'm just a little intrigued by the, I guess you call it the gematria of 14 generations from the various different markers that are mentioned in Matthew 16. It's a double seven, and I'm just intrigued by what that means. You know, is it like a matter that's established to be complete or what?
Well, gematria is a practice that's in the Kabbalah, and Kabbalah is witchcraft done Jewish style. It came out of Babylon, and we don't get into that one either because we're supposed to stay away from all sorcery. Anybody else? Brenda?
Okay, so if you add the 14 and the 14 and the 14 together, you get 42, and 42 is always an awesome number in the Bible. I always look at that part instead of the gematria.
Okay, thank you, Brenda. Anybody else? Okay. Well, Father, we thank you for this time together, and we thank you for Rick's message, and I pray that everybody was uplifted and encouraged to continue on their track with you and to keep their faith and to keep going in whatever direction you have called them into. Father, I pray that you'll be with us as we go through this week and bring us all back together next Shabbat. In Yeshua's name, amen.
Amen.
Shabbat shalom, everybody.
Shabbat shalom, everyone. Have a wonderful
Shabbat
week.
Shalom from New Mexico.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom from Iowa.